Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 528.PS6104, certificate number 41746. The Gimli Glider.
And my axe.
How long has it been since we've done an aviation theme, or rather, how long has it been since I've done an aviation themed episode?
Probably same answer. 12 minutes.
12 minutes since our last one.
I don't know.
You've never been in a plane crash.
I thought you were going to say you've never been in a plane.
You've
never been in a plane. That's correct. I take trains everywhere.
No, I know for a fact that one of your internet, one of your internet bits is to take pictures of the mountains, specifically Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens.
If we're flying over Mount St. Helens, for some reason, I just tend to notice because, hey, Mount St. Helens.
There it is. It's very noticeable.
And I always put it online.
You're like, there it is again.
Update, Mount St. Helens not erupting
still
today.
Still not erupting.
And the funny thing is the National Park System, or whoever that is, has started to reply.
Oh, do they have some young person that's like, lol.
Let's make volcanology hip.
Yeah.
Let's vibe with volcanoes.
St. Helens Stan. And so now they're bantering with you?
Yeah, they'll reply and be like, yeah, that's what our cameras show too. And they're just trying to get links to their cameras. And their cameras are better than me looking down from a...
Are they
from an Airbus flight?
I've been to that. I've been to that visitor center. they could stand to clean the windows there.
They've had a rough 40 years of that visitor center.
Have you been up there recently?
It's been a decade, maybe.
Yeah, there's a trail system, you know, and they're trying to fix it because it's a little bit knackered.
Knackered?
So it's knackered.
It's gone pear-shaped?
It has gone pear-shaped. And so there's a lot of stuff. You know, it's the mountains. It crumbles over time. But also, people forget how much wind there is on a mountaintop.
Yeah.
And the wind really scours. It's a scouring wind. That's the technical term. And so I
go there for my skin.
Yeah. I feel like it is.
I don't want those little Thai fish nibbling at me. I want the dermabrasion of the Cascades.
Yeah, you come down with very, very pink skin. You would be...
Even pinker.
Even pinker. But anyway, I feel like the visitor center... Because Weyerhaeuser just built that big Weyerhaeuser Center, and it's so new and so dedicated to telling the story of... the valiant story of how Weyerhaeuser valiantly fought the noble trees...
What's better for nature than cutting down all the trees?
Yes, that's right.
Some would say nothing.
They cut down the trees in a very, very sustainable way, Weyerhaeuser will tell you.
And then they replanted them.
Yes, also very sustainable.
To cut them down again.
In wonderful rows.
Here's what's sustainable. Cutting down these trees. We want to make sure we can keep cutting them down. We have a commitment to always cutting down every tree we plant.
Always be cutting. A, B, C. Always be cutting.
Coffees for lumberjacks only.
But if you compare the two visitor centers, boy, it's a real like
corporate money versus government.
Yeah,
money.
It's an Epcot Center versus Marriott's Great America type of thing. That's not a fair comparison.
I was waiting to see if the thing was going to be better or worse than Epcot.
I'm not sure.
Let's see.
I don't know. I haven't been to Marriott's Great America in many. Is it still there? Marriott's Great America seems like a thing you would know.
Is that in Florida?
No, that's the problem. I was making a comparison, a cross country comparison. That's not. the same.
What's Marriott's Great America?
See, so maybe it isn't there. Marriott's Great America.
Let's just change the topic of this omnibus.
Marriott's Great America was a an old amusement park in California.
Uh-huh.
Marriott's sponsored, obviously, by the Marriott Hotel chain.
They had an amusement park? Was there a little Gideon's and a Book of Mormon in every roller coaster pouch?
It was a thing like that, but it was great. It had like I don't know, great, but it had things.
I mean, I'm aware of Magic Mountain and Knott's Berry Farm.
So it started in 1976, which was the peak. That was
bicentennial.
Peak.
That's Great America time.
Yeah, peak Great America, but it doesn't say if it petered out, which apparently it surely did. If you loved Marriott's Great America as I did, Futurelings, just drop us a line.
What I love about those places is like which characters they license.
Right.
Because they know that, you know, since 1955, kids have wanted to go to Disneyland to meet Mickey and Donald. So they're like, well, how do we get them to Mall of America?
We can't get Sylvester and Tweety Bird.
Can we get Ziggy? Can we get, you know, like, can we get Woody Woodpecker to be at our weird park?
Yeah, it ends up being
Doonesbury and Zonker.
I did a couple of cruises on one of those cruise lines that had licensed some characters, and it was definitely Deputy Dog level of, you know, like, oh wow, I can't believe that it's you know, it's like,
kids, you're going to meet the GoBots.
Yeah, it's on Ernest this cruise. From Ernest Goes to Mexico.
It's a guy in a big Ernest head.
But they did a parade every night down Main Street, which was just a bunch of, you know,
with their sad characters.
Yeah,
with Lippy the Lion and Hardy Har Har.
And they couldn't, because it's a cruise ship, right? There's, it's not like there's a Gucci store. It's all right. It's all Tanzanite.
Tanzanite all the way down.
But
yes, I have never been in a plane crash, and that's a big part of why I'm here today. I attribute a lot of my longevity and good health to never having been in a plane crash.
You and I both, in the course of our careers, have spent a lot of time on airplanes, flying across these great American states, and then also to points far afield.
Building medallion status.
That's right. Well, I'm still silver.
Silver.
I'm still silver.
I'm not actually a good medallion. I'm all Alaska now.
Oh, yeah. That's the problem. Alaska is just like, oh, good job. Pat on the head.
They don't even have a thing. They just give
There's
you
some peanuts.
It's a different number. They don't even give you a nice thing like, oh, now you're opal. They don't even have, or now you're green.
But you get the big chairs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the big chairs aren't like, I mean.
It's nice to get upgraded into the big chairs because you're like, oh, boy, I didn't deserve this.
But if you were platinum on Delta, you might get those layback things on your long across the world flights.
That's true. But big not they used to have those on Seattle JFK, and now they hardly ever do.
Yeah.
The little pod bay doors.
It's not worth it. Yeah.
I mean, they have them on LA to JFK, but I never do that.
Yeah, because that's all the rich people.
Exactly. Yeah. The last time I did that, I saw Uzo Aduba from Orange is the New Black.
Oh, no
she
kidding.
She was in the next pod.
No kidding.
Did not talk to her.
I feel like my experience of knowing people who do that flight a lot is that the only people that ever get upgraded are like double black diamond.
Right.
And they already paid $9,000 for their flight because it's just George Clooney both directions.
I mean, it often happens when you've got, when I used to live in Salt Lake, I never got upgraded on Delta because every single person in Salt Lake City has Delta status.
Of course.
Because it's
a hub.
It's the only hub.
Yeah.
And they give it to you. The mayor gives you, when a baby is born in Salt Lake City, he or she is given.
If they join the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts. Yeah, I've learned a lot from you. Did you ever get the key to the city of Salt Lake?
No, I have one key to the city, and I think it's Dearborn, Michigan. It's not the one I wanted. No offense to the fine people of Dearborn.
What was the one you wanted? San Francisco. If you could get the key to one city,
that's
what
a great
would it be?
Question.
Yeah,
you'd have to find out what the rarest one is. Like if Galveston has never given a key, you're like, I want.
Oh wait, that's the thing you want is the rareness.
Yeah.
Oh,
I want the one of a kind, or maybe there's one other person who got it, and it's like
Johnny Cash.
Yeah, exactly. It's not Nathan Bedford Forrest or something. It's like Frederick Douglass or Elvis or something.
See, I would want one to a city that I felt like then I could go exploit my key.
Does the key do anything?
Well, if you're like...
It doesn't open every door. It's not a skeleton key.
If you're in Amsterdam or Berlin and you have a key to the city, nobody there cares, right?
Do they even have that?
Probably not. You could carry it around on your head because they're so blasé. But if you had a key to the city of St. Louis, you could probably eat for free everywhere you went. You'd go into any steakhouse in the city and just
wave it over your head.
I'd be like, What is this good for if not free steaks?
So you just want a city with good steak? You want a key to the city of Omaha?
No, I feel like I've stopped eating steak.
Yeah.
It no longer has the appeal.
Santa Barbara.
Whoa. That's a great key to the city. Yeah,
that's it.
Santa Barbara. Going to any, like Aeropostale or,
all the little,
what is a store that really like tells the story of Santa Barbara?
Santa Barbara store.
Anthropology.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I've never been in a plane crash, although I've almost crashed a plane, but my dad was in a plane crash. He crashed our plane.
Were you not in it?
I was not in it. And when I heard he had crashed the plane, he was still in a status of having crashed in the wilderness of the Yukon Territories in Canada.
How did you hear he got on the radio?
Well, he was on the radio in the process of crashing.
Was that the problem?
He was
paying attention to the road?
Breaker 19. No, he was actually flying from Anchorage to visit me in Spokane and did not arrive because he crashed in the wilderness. And so when I was like, my guy should be here pretty soon. I got a call and it was on the phone in the hall in my dorm. This was back when
John, your dad's had a plane crash.
Yeah. Hey, John,
I need the phone.
And then you run down and, there's only one form. No one younger than us will ever know what we're talking
about. This seems insane.
But there was one phone per floor in the dorms, giant dorm.
You had to get up every morning at 5 and start the wood fire.
Yeah, that's right. One shower on the on the floor, too. And yeah, there was one. And you couldn't sit there and just talk to your girlfriend, right? Because there were calls coming in all the time. So somebody said, John, phone for you. And I got down there, and it was somebody.
Is it the FAA?
No, because it was in Canada. And it wasn't in the Yukon Territory.
Was it the Royal AA?
It was the Royal AA.
Royal Canadian.
His Majesty's AA. No, it was in North BC. It was up around Prince Rupert, but still in the trees. And it was the Mounties, really, calling and saying, there's been a plane crash.
Cool story, though. Like, bummer that it's to tell you your dad might be dead. But second, a Mountie's calling
you. Yeah, the Mounties. And then I spent, you know, like a lot of things in the old days, then you spent several anxiety-filled hours wondering what the next call is going to bring. We were in 89, I was in Europe, and we heard about the earthquake in San Francisco.
Right.
And, but there was no information. And I was traveling with a couple of guys from the Bay Area, and all we heard was that the Bay Bridge had collapsed. And trying to imagine—
And you didn't know that meant just one level.
Just one level. Right. Had, just trying to imagine, like, what kind of earthquake would collapse the Bay Bridge and the Embarcadero? We were just picturing tens of thousands of dead, cities in flames. And it took another day for the news to finally get to us that, like, no, it's okay. Some people died.
We're going to replay that World Series game.
Yeah, but your mom and dad are fine. But by the time I got my dad on the phone, he called from a bar in some little town outside of Prince Rupert, said, I'm okay. And the first thing he said was, God, I wish you'd been with me. And in his and my relationship, that was the most natural thing for him to say, because I wished I'd been with him too. You crashed the plane
and I missed it
without me? Like, come on. And he was with a kid. He was giving a ride to a kid I knew who was going off to college, and his mom had said to my dad, well, why don't you take him down to school on your way to see your son?
He was going to Wazoo or Gonzaga or something
like that. And according to my dad, as soon as the crash was imminent, he was just screaming and crying and being a total pain in the ass. Part of what he wanted was me to be there and be like
a better co-pilot.
Right? But the reason my dad crashed was that he ran out of gas.
What?
And that is very...
I've never run out of gas driving, much less flying.
Well, I've run out of gas a lot driving.
I've been in a car that ran out of gas once or twice. But I was asleep in the back and have no moral culpability.
Yeah, you know, I have bipolar disorder, and so I have run out of gas.
Irrational confidence. Is it a bad time for irrational confidence if you're, like, outside Battle Mountain, Nevada, or...
Yeah, really bad.
I'll probably make...
That's the thing.
Kelso?
I used to do that all the time. You know, drive by the last gas station with the car nearing empty and saying, it's fine. I don't like that gas station. Let's just keep going. We'll find another.
I don't think I'm bipolar, but I do have like a slight irrational urge toward very low stakes risk taking.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, ooh, let me see if I can take the last flight in or, so far it's never let me run out of gas.
Two years ago on our family cross country trip, I ran out of gas in that corner of Wyoming where... There is no gas.
That's all four corners of Wyoming.
I know. But it was the corner where it was like, oh, and it also happened to be like sundown.
Yeah.
And my family was very disappointed in me. And it was the same. It was the thing where they were like, don't you want to get gas? And I've been on bipolar medication for 8 years now. But still, I said.
They're still trying to lick that one symptom.
Oh, come on. We can make it to the next. And we got to the next town and the gas station had been closed since the 70s.
Oh.
Used to happen a lot. But no, in this case, one of the things, I mean, when you're flying in an airplane, there are checklists, there are dozens and dozens of things you make sure you've checked and double-checked because it's not a mode of transportation that you want there to be.
Yeah, it's not forgiving.
Yeah, something unexpected happening.
And are you saying fuel is not on that checklist?
It absolutely is.
It's right near the top.
Fuel is really an important aspect, and especially in this kind of cross-country flying where really the legs of his trip are more or less prescribed by the distance you can travel on a tank of gas.
You have to refuel that plane multiple times to get from Anchorage to Eastern Washington.
He was flying in a Cessna 182, and so, you know, and there is an archipelago of gas stations that everybody knows that makes that flight, and you can land at these various...
Is it self-serve?
Developed strips. There's generally like a kid whose summer job it is to sit there and fill up planes as they come through. Mm. And this is, you know, this part of BC, Yukon territories and Alaska, it's all small plane culture.
Yeah.
So a lot of little airports just running airplanes in backwards and forth. I actually really wanted that job.
It's not too late.
It's too late for me now. But at Merrill Field, when I was in high school, there was a place my dad used to get his plane serviced, and I just watched those slightly older teenagers up there filling up the gas, and it just felt like, you know, coming from a time when being the full-service gas station attendant also seemed cool. When
sure.
You were like 8 years old, wow, they get to run the machines and everything. But I never got that job. I never managed to convince anyone I was responsible enough to put gas in an airplane.
I feel like you might have reached that point now. It's time to go back.
Yeah.
Rodney Dangerfield, back to school, but it's you working in a very small airfield.
You know, we have a listener in Texas.
I don't believe it.
It's true. We have more than one.
Exactly one.
But one of them is an instructor, small plane
flight
instructor, who has offered to... help me re-get my pilot's license if I want to come down to Texas for 10 days. And he said, we'll just fly every day and we'll study. And by the end of the week, you'll have your private again. And it's very appealing to me.
Except that you don't want to be in Texas for 10 days.
No, I would even do that. But I think when I was thinking about what crazy things should I do to give myself like a new lease on life, I decided I was going to go to Israel instead of go to Texas and get my pilot's license. Partly because of the suspicion that maybe bipolar disorder and pilot's licenses are not the most compatible two conditions to have.
Well, one is treatable. I guess you can treat both of them. You've let your license lapse and you're medicated for the other.
Yeah, but I keep running out of gas. It's kind of like being a crackhead and a locksmith. You don't want to give a locksmith certification to a crackhead, right? That just seems like...
It might make their locksmith powers too good. It might concentrate their abilities.
That's right. Ed Lattimore says...
Super locksmith.
Nobody is as motivated and as ambitious as a crackhead. But in trying to... Because my dad is a very experienced pilot. He learned to fly in 1943. He's you know, flown all around the world. And
what went wrong?
How the heck? And that was the second thing I said to him. How the heck did you run out of gas? It's the, and he landed it in the trees. Like when he finally, because he could see, I think he could see a strip, and he knew he wasn't going to be able to make it.
And it's, and had he already run out of gas, or was he like, I know I can't make the next station?
This is the problem. He ran out of gas, and it was a tremendous surprise.
He discovered it as the engine.
They're flying along, and the.
That's not what you want.
And then. And of course, the pilot's instinct is like, oh, well, that's just a mouse got caught in the carburetor, and, you know, then trying to start it again.
Did he tap his gauge with one fingernail?
And then looking down and realizing, oh, wow, I'm out of gas. How did that happen? And how did it happen? Because he'd gotten fueled up at the appropriate gas station. They had tested with all their, I mean, you have to guess that they tested to make sure the tank was full.
It wasn't his error.
He didn't get up there with a dipstick and stick it in the, because this is a way to test how much gas is in an airplane. It may surprise you to learn, and it's part of the story today, that they still use dipsticks that they stick in the hole and pull back out and go, oh, there's enough gas in there.
I mean, that's still how car oil gauges work.
Yeah, but you wouldn't think that it was true in airplanes, especially, as we'll see, in wide-bodied jumbo jets.
It really is just a sign that you should not trust advanced technology, that the more things advance, the more ways they can break, and therefore, when the chips are really down, people would rather trust a strip of metal.
Well, that is a big part of our story today. In trying to...
By the way, between your dad and your chemistry teacher, you have a lot of bad pilot role models, and maybe you should not be recertifying.
Oh, I mean, one of my all-time heroes, as was true for a lot of Alaskan kids, a legendary Alaska bush pilot by the name of Don Sheldon, who was, I think, the first pilot to land an airplane on Mount McKinley. He was just this swashbuckling kind of...
I think we've talked about Don before. Yeah, Don is known to the future.
Don is known to the future, right? It was Don Sheldon's daughter that came up, I think, if not on this show, then on a... I've told the story of Don Sheldon's daughter because I've... Although she and I have never met, we have a deep connection from the mid-80s. I'll just tell the story very briefly. Don Sheldon, legendary bush pilot, ended up dying.
In pilot-related ways? In an aeronautical way?
No, Don Sheldon died of cancer, which is an inglorious end to a legendary airplaner. His daughter, they lived in Talkeetna, a tiny little Alaskan town at the time, and there was a Alaska statewide essay contest. Not essay, I guess short story contest. And the principal of my high school was one of the judges of the statewide essay contest. And as you know, I graduated last in my class from high school.
Principal didn't love you.
Principal loved me and knew that I would be skipping class generally. And so he would allow me to skip class if I came and sat in his office.
Got it.
And at one point he said, I have to judge all of these statewide essays. Why don't you do me a favor and read them and just separate them into three piles? You can put the ones that just aren't going to cut the mustard, ones that you think are fine, and the good ones. And so I would sit in his office and read these essays from kids all across the state. Well, one of these stories was a story from Talkeetna, written by a girl who had, it was basically a sex fantasy. The story was about an outsider, a boy from outside, a rakish.
Don't most boys come from outside? What's it called? Talkeetna?
Talkeetna, yeah. But outsider means from not Alaska.
I see.
Who came there, and I don't think he was a vampire. That element of the storytelling hadn't arrived in the scene yet.
He was sparkly, but...
Yeah. He was a dark-haired, beautiful boy who didn't know anything. And she showed him the Alaska ways. She taught him to ride a horse. I mean. They would ride down, you know, she taught him how to pan for gold and how to make a bong out of a potato and all the great Alaska things. And it was really like a, you know, it was really a teenage girl's fantasy of like her first boyfriend. And it was written by Don Sheldon's daughter.
Did you know that?
Her last name, Sheldon, obviously, and I knew from Tolkien. Yeah, right. So I made the assumption and then later did the research and realized it was her. And so having read her essay and definitely put it in the file or in the pile of like, oh yes, you know, you've got to read this one. I've always felt like maybe I should go up there, pretend to be from outside and just enact the whole fantasy for her. I know every detail.
Isn't she in her 50s now?
Well, yeah. And but
you,
I mean, I could.
You think she'd still be? No, think she'd leave her wife this. And kids. Oh,
I should have done this in the '80s because I was a lonely heart, and she's up there a lonely heart. But you know, would that be a meet cute? Would that be a great romantic, like a rom com plot, or is that would that be like?
Well, all great rom com meet cutes are creepy on some level.
Exactly.
So I think it's. I think this could absolutely be. I mean, if Alaska rom com was a genre.
Yeah. Oh well, it should be. And I could have, I actually should have done that. But no, I never met her. But we had our tall Keaton and Bush pilot, whose name was Cliff Hudson. And Cliff Hudson and Don Sheldon had been competitors in flying people up to Mount McKinley.
Why were you a Cliff head instead of a Don
Sheldon? Don Sheldon died in 1975.
Different eras.
Cliff was still, well, no, they're the same age. But Cliff was still alive in the 80s. Cliff used to fly with a little poodle on his lap. And he took us up into the bush a lot. And one time I was sitting talking to Cliff Hudson about Don Sheldon because there's a book about Don, like he's a big Alaska character. And so I was kind of waxing about like, wow, Don Sheldon, you know, Don, he survived like, I don't know how many, 15 plane crashes or something. And Cliff Hudson, who was a very laconic pilot, said, well, you know, the secret isn't to survive 15 plane crashes. It's to not get into a plane crash.
Oh, burn.
And Cliff had never crashed a plane. And it was the sickest burn, sickest bush pilot burn that I ever
Two
heard.
Different approaches exactly. To bush pilot or to any, literally. Or to anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, differently.
Cliff made a different approach.
A much shallower approach in his case.
Didn't land it in the trees. My dad did. He broke both the wings off of the airplane. Ended up selling the wreckage of the plane to a guy in a bar for $50 Canadian.
So set the scene. He's just trying to find some clear, flat enough space.
There was
there's nothing because it's all trees.
It was just forest.
So you just have to plow into the tops of trees and hope that slows you down.
Well, his great innovation, as he was, you know, he's coming in again, and he knows he's just going straight into a forest, and. Your instinct, of course, is to pull back on the stick like you're landing and to, you know, kind of flare the airplane and try and slow it down and drop it into the trees. But as he started to hear the tips of these trees, contact the airplane, he realized that there was every possibility that one of these trees was just going to come straight up through the fuselage. You know, they were going to get impaled. Mm-hmm. And so at the very last minute, hitting the tops of the trees, branches, he pushed in on the yoke and the plane went nose down. And basically the wings then caught the trees, broke the wings off, and the plane came to the fuselage with him and this kid in it.
Screaming kid.
Came to rest upside down.
Like on the ground or is it suspended in branches?
Hanging in branches.
What if you're like 150 feet up?
Well, they weren't that high. You know, they were high enough that it was precarious, but they were able to get out and kind of climb down.
Yeah.
And the Mounties came and found them.
There's always Mounties.
But how did they run out of gas? My dad's been doing this for decades at this point. Running out of gas is kind of a... When you're sitting around the airplane bar and everybody's talking about their best crashes, like running out of gas in British Columbia is not the coolest version. He didn't get shot down by the Japanese. He didn't.
Is that the coolest one?
I think. Well, yeah, right. Shot down by the Japanese or shot down over Hanover, and then you spend the rest of the war in a prison camp. That's also pretty cool.
Shot down domestically, not so good.
Not as
good.
Shot down
by the Civil Air Patrol.
Not as good. Being in an airplane where a guy sets off a bomb that was in his shoe.
Yeah.
still not as good, but running out of gas.
Mm. Commercial air pilot on Southwest where the whole top of the fuselage comes off.
That'd be pretty cool.
That's a good one. Not your fault.
But in trying to retrace his steps, he was like, was it the kid that was putting gas in the plane? Was it some kind of, there wasn't a leak.
No leak.
And what he came up with was that there was maybe a confusion in imperial measurement versus metric.
And I told you before, I love these.
Yeah. And that because Canada used both, and in aviation used both sort of simultaneously, there was a long transition period where...
Like he wanted 30 gallons, got 30 liters or something?
Well, it would be the other way around, right? If you wanted 30 liters and got 30 gallons, that would be a lot less than you had planned. He never worked it out.
It could have been dollars. He's like, hey, fill it up. I want $100 worth of gas.
Yeah,
and it 100 was Canadian. Yes, sir.
100 Canadian. Well, let's see. Yeah, that's right. That would have been only 75% of your the gas you needed. Ken, you know, I have a tendency to think that people younger than us who grew up with the internet just instinctively know how to do all kinds of internet things, like put their font into italics, or
is that an internet thing?
Send an email, go online,
fix their printer driver.
But in fact, I think even Gen Z and millennial peoples don't always know how to create a beautiful website.
I used to work in web programming and web design, and that's because it is a difficult and complicated skill, and the web is more difficult and complicated every day.
Mm-hmm.
But with that complication has come a market opportunity, which is what if you could just help people easily build cool, amazing-looking websites that do everything they need?
That's the thing. This is a thing that crosses all generations. Lots of people of all different ages have cool ideas. And if you have a cool idea and want to turn it into something that's online, and why wouldn't you? If you want to do more than just post pictures of yourself standing next to it on Instagram, you want to actually make a website for it.
If you have a cool idea and it's offline only, does it even exist?
That's the thing. No, it doesn't.
What are you doing? Are you placing a classified ad?
Unless you're selling pots at a fair. But even then, you're going to want to put them online because people are going to go, can I get these on the internet? I'd rather not carry it home.
If you're selling turnips at a farmer's market, maybe you don't need Squarespace. But everyone else listening.
Because here's what you want to do. You want to showcase your work.
Yep.
You want to maybe blog about your experience, both coming up with your cool ideas and putting the rubber to the road.
Yeah, built-in blogging and commenting features.
You want to sell stuff. You want to sell not just products, but services.
Built-in shopping carts and scheduling tools.
Also, of course, one of the hardest things, promotion, which is also like a massive challenge.
Not with Squarespace, it's not, John.
What? Squarespace? What? No one expects the Squarespace revolution.
Oh, did we not name the sponsor yet?
Not yet, no.
Here's what unifies all the generations.
Yes.
A love for the amazing websites that can be generated with Squarespace.
Here's what Squarespace does for you. Squarespace gives you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, and I can confirm that. The templates themselves, beautiful right out of the box, before you even fill them with your own content.
They should be in a museum, each template.
They have powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online. Now, our younger listeners are going to know what e-commerce means. But like our boomer listeners are going to have to do the math on that.
It's
e-commerce.
It's like commerce.
E-commerce.
But you've taken E beforehand?
It's a lowercase E and then an uppercase C too. E-commerce. Squarespace also gives you the ability to customize the look, feel, settings, products, and more of your new website with just a few clicks.
Let's tell our listeners how to take advantage. If you need a website for any reason, you're selling something, you're making something, you're doing something, you want to be out there, go to squarespace.com/omnibus to start your free trial. Then when you're ready to launch, use offer code omnibus again. It's the magic word. And you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's squarespace.com/omnibus for a free trial. So go on, test it out, build it out, see how you like it.
See what you think. Tell us what you think.
And then when you're ready to launch, use the offer code Omnibus and save 10% off your first purchase.
Again, everyone but turnip farmers. Please, no turnip farmers apply.
In 1982, a new Boeing airplane arrived on the scene. Can you think of which one?
Is it still in service?
Yes.
I don't know. 82. What's old? 737?
No.
Is that older?
Yeah.
So right? 707?
No, that's too old.
That's like the workhorse from the...
Yeah, that's the early one.
60s and
70s. No, it was the 767.
767.
The 767 arrived on the scene, and the 767 had a few real innovations for its time. 767 was the first wide-body jet that only had two engines.
Hmm.
Prior to that, you know, the 747 was
right.
was set the standard of wide-body jet, and it had four engines because there was a lot of, there was a feeling if you were going to fly across the ocean or fly a long distance, you needed...
Is that redundancy more than power?
Yeah. Okay. You needed the
You don't need four engines to lift a bubble tiki bar into the air.
Well, I think engines then, you know, definitely didn't have the thrust that later ones did. But it was also that feeling of redundancy. If you're out over the middle of the Pacific Ocean and you lose an engine and you've got three more, that's fine. If you only have one more, that's not as confidence inspiring.
The plane tilts.
So it was a wide body jet with only two engines, but there were a couple of other innovations. During the 1970s, of course, there was a fuel crisis and there was a change in the way that airlines thought of what the best version of an airplane was that went from how many people can we put on it to how fuel efficient can we make these airplanes. And there were a lot of cost-saving measures, attempts to lighten airplanes. And the 767 was a plane that eliminated the flight engineer. So prior to this...
Right, there's like a third guy. Yeah, you always see this in old movies.
There was always a
third guy in there with, you know, a map or something.
Yeah, and he's sitting in a separate station. There's the pilot, the co-pilot, and then a guy sitting behind them.
Seems like a real third wheel.
Well,
the vibe is not good. You want that guy out of there.
If you're talking about gauges, having gauges in an airplane that are controlling all these complicated systems, and there are electromechanical gauges, like actual, all the systems are analog, mm-hmm. right? You have a thousand little gauges monitoring every aspect of the plane.
You need more eyeballs. Even if it gets a weird thruple vibe into your cockpit.
Well, but the guy sitting in the engineer spot is the one with all the quips.
He can bring you your sandwich or whatever.
Well, he's not going to do that. He's a pilot also, but he's the one that leans back and goes, "Hey, have you ever, how do you like Gladiator movies or whatever?" But they've eliminated that because they're also making a transition from electromechanical instrumentation to purely electric instrumentation and control of the aircraft, right? It's no longer so that you are, when you are both moving the controls and also monitoring the controls, that they are connected by mechanical connection to the systems that they're operating. Now it's just what we would call computers.
And does that make it, it seems like that would make it less reliable?
Well, certainly lighter. As we'll see, there are some challenges.
I'm just saying, why don't you need the third guy? Is the idea that these new systems are better at alerting you, so you don't need
constant
scanning? Or?
But also, on your screens in front of you, you can now choose what you're looking at. So one of the reasons that you couldn't just have two pilots monitoring all the systems is it would be an impossible number of gauges that we're doing, and you'd never be able, it would be clutter, you'd never be able to figure out what you were looking
at. A lot of it is user interface design.
Right. So now you can scroll through, or the plane is programmed to show you screens that are...
What you need when, relevant.
Exactly, that are applicable. So you have one fewer person in the cockpit, and also it's a new system of... where when you look at and this is what you'd see if you went into the cockpit of any modern airplane, there are no longer really any actual little circular gauges with a needle in it that is going back and forth.
What a bummer. They should put those in just for show.
There are, I think, a few redundant electrical instruments for situations like the one we're about to experience, but everything else is a computer simulation of a little circular gauge, because just like when we go on our phones, the little icon looks like some old fashioned.
It's like a clock.
Yeah,
it's like a handset or a
phone or a letter within an envelope. We still are using that kind of iconography. On the day in question,
which is when, 82?
So this is in the summer of 1983. A Canadian Airlines, or rather Air Canada 767, a brand new airplane. The airplane had only just passed its flight exams and entered into service as a viable aircraft.
It's just come out of a barn in Everett or wherever.
That's right. This is the fourth airplane off the assembly line.
Oh, wow.
The fourth 767 to enter service. And they are still really writing the manual from the time that the airplane left the factory in Everett to the day in question, July 22nd, 1983. 55 additional citations had been discovered that had not yet made it into the flight manual. The back of the flight manual is a bunch of blank pages.
And these all get mailed out.
Yeah.
You probably paste it in.
Like, oh, by the way, we've noticed a problem with the Fritzenjammer. And in order to solve the Fritzenjammer problem, you have to put a flan spanner in the yoke.
It's just funny to imagine a time when it's not an email and an automatic adjustment to things.
Right. And it goes out to the mechanics, right? There's a massive group of technicians that are maintaining and servicing these planes as they fly from coast to coast, up and down the line. And one of the things that they've noticed in the very, the early weeks of flying the 767 is that there's a problem, there's a bug in the fuel quantity indicator sensor.
The FQIS.
That's right. The FQIS, and in the 767, there are two FQIS, so they're redundant. And there is a known issue that the FQISs are throwing up. They're failing.
And will they be wrong in sync, or will the backup one help you out if your first one's wrong?
Well, this is the thing. If the FQIS, if one of the two fails, it will register as a system failure. And then if you disable one, the failing one, the other one works fine.
Okay.
But if they're both on, the screen blanks.
The second
out.
One never, okay.
Yeah. So it's recognized that there's a defective FQIS. And the technician that recognized it made an entry saying, one of the FQISs is busted, so I disabled it. The other one should be fine.
This is this particular craft?
This is just this one airplane, the what will become Flight 143. At this time, there have been so many alterations and, so many sort of we're working the bugs out of this brand new airplane, that the normal system that you would use to decide whether or not an airplane was safe to fly has sort of been... there's enough workarounds that they're just saying, well, if the technicians on the ground say it's safe to fly, we're going to...
It's more of a vibe at this point.
That's right. And it's the early 80s, right? So there's a lot, it's sort of...
Deregulation, baby.
Hey.
Reagan era.
And, it's just kind of like a Bill Murray in Stripes era anyway, where everybody's like, it's fine. A guy with a backwards baseball hat is like, don't worry about it.
I've seen this before.
Without the dual FQIS,
this is the first time I've ever said one of these BS acronyms, and you've actually kept it up.
Yeah, I like it. I like FQIS.
Do you think that's what the technicians would have said?
I'm sure it is. Yeah. They probably said FQ or whatever. They might have just said.
Yeah, they probably said FQ.
FQ. Hey, FQ, buddy.
FQ, mom.
But what the manual said was, if one of the FQISs fail, the other one should be fine. But in order for there to be redundancy, you need to also actually get up on the wing and stick a dipstick into the gas tank of this brand new airplane and just make sure that you've got enough.
Hard to do in flight.
Very hard to do in flight.
You got to get the little gremlin guy to do it.
And so they do the dipstick reading, and they and the FQIS, the single one, is working.
Where's his flight heading from and to?
Well, so on the day that they are that they recognize the problem, the plane is in Edmonton, which, as you know, is the capital of Alberta. A great province. Edmonton, a hilarious.
I've never been to Alberta.
Have you not?
No, not even Calgary.
Calgary is a great town, very Denver-like. Edmonton is like, it's very much like Anchorage. If you took Anchorage and made it four times as big and put it in Canada.
Fewer people, or is it?
No, it's lots more people. Of people. Lots of Edmonton's people. A big town. And it, but it's up there. It's up above the line where trees are no longer big.
I'm going to change my answer. I want a key to the city of Edmonton.
It's pretty, well, you know, and then it became like an oil rush town, and it's a real, I mean, these are all cowboy towns. It's Alberta. It's just like, it's an extension of North Dakota.
Do they have a stampede?
They're going to be super mad at me saying that.
Yeah, but there's like six of them. You can take them.
I'm not sure if Edmonton has a stampede.
That's what I don't know. Does every city have a stampede, or is Calgary like, no way?
The only two I know are Calgary, like, and OMAC.
Is it like Mardi Gras, or is it like, you know, something that only one city has? Lollapalooza.
It's Canada, so they probably don't have as many gunfights as we would have in the United States. I've only been there once, and we played a rock show there, and it was a great time. And I was impressed by the town, but not enough time to really get the whole measure of their character.
Maybe Canada's small enough that you get a key to the whole province.
Like, oh, a key to Alberta.
Yeah. Congratulations, Ken. For your contributions.
You're an honorary Albertan.
Yeah, you get a key to the province of Alberta.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Well, in this case, they discovered the broken FQIS. In Edmonton, and they said, look, we'll finish out this run. The flight's going to Toronto first, and then Montreal.
Did you say Montreal?
Montreal. Okay. It's like Eugene.
Is that your mantra?
My mantra is that Montreal is pronounced that way. Montreal. And then it's going to overnight in Montreal, and then it's going to come back to Edmonton the following day. But the return flight through Ottawa.
Okay.
The great capital of Canada.
It is great.
It's amazing there. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of nice. The federal architecture, they wouldn't say federal. Whatever their national parliamentary architecture is nice.
It is.
The Rideau Canal.
It's like if you took some of the nice buildings from London,
yeah,
but you didn't have all the other buildings that make up London.
Yeah, it's like
just the buildings.
We just took out kind of the old-timey European capital stuff,
yeah,
and dropped it on this... plateau.
And then there's a lot of grass in between them instead of, like, you know, Savile Row Taylors and whatnot.
It's one of those capitals that was chosen because it was halfway between the two cities that actually wanted to be capital.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Olympia here in Washington.
Didn't really have any of its own merits.
But here's the issue. At this time, Air Canada still converted metric.
Yeah.
To Imperial at the level of gasoline.
I shouldn't say I love these because sometimes they kill people, but boy, do I love these.
Complicating it is, you know, you're calculating volume and weight. And so in calculating how much gas you need, you go from centimeters of gas, you translate that into how many liters, how many, you know, because you're measuring with the dipstick.
Right. So how tall you're...
Here's how many centimeters of gas you have. Now, how many liters does that represent? But when you buy gas, you buy it by weight. So how many liters is that? Therefore, how many kilograms of gasoline is that? And then you translate that to how many Imperial gallons it represents.
Because you have to, that's how it's purchased, or?
That's how it's purchased. Okay. In Canada at the time.
Here's how many kilograms I need, but I need to tell the guy how many gallons I want.
How many centimeters of gas in the thing translates through these various processes to how many imperial gallons I need to buy.
And it's, you know, it's up to the individual heart of the listener whether we blame this on the metric system or other on the imperial system.
Or just on Canadians in general.
Or having two, yeah. The real problem is having two.
The problem that we'll see in this is that the 767 is the first Boeing aircraft that uses metric measurements for fuel.
And is this a result of the unsuccessful metric movement in the United States of the previous era, the late 70s?
I think it is more that Boeing is trying to sell airplanes internationally,
yeah.
that's the market they're really trying to explore. And so they've switched over to metric, and then America has to figure it out, right? American airports gradually, I think, had to accommodate the fact that international sales was more important to Boeing than maintaining our arcane systems of weight and measurement.
And not just American, but North American, because Canada's got their schizophrenic bisexual measurement system.
They do. And at this time, they're still using gallons instead of liters. The following day, the plane then, starting in Montreal, has a new flight crew. The captain is Bob Pearson. And the first officer is Maurice Quintal.
Is there always one Anglo and one French guy in a Canadian cockpit?
No. And that's the thing. The pilots that flew it there, that understood that had talked to the original technician, understood that the FQIS was broken, understood that you needed to pull the fuse to disable the FQIS so that the other one worked, and understood how much gas was in there based on their measurement stick. They were two pilots. The captain was John Weir, and his co-pilot, Don Johnson.
Oh, there's no...
Television's Don Johnson.
That's amazing. You want Philip Michael Thomas to be the other guy, but there's no Jean-Marie guy in the other seat.
So,
because I've never flown Air Canada, but I bet they do the announcements in...
they do.
In bilingual, just like the...
I'm sure they do it in packaging. French, and 90% of Canadians go, I learned it in high school, but I don't understand what...
Just like a Canadian box of Rice-A-Roni. There's some little French part you ignore.
Well, my truck... was it originally a Canadian market truck?
Oh, really?
And the little stickers that say objects in mirrors are smaller than they appear. It was a Montreal truck, and they're in French. So I have no idea how big the objects in my mirrors are.
I think I've had a car that had bilingual those. Like, they just want to have both stickers for the Canadian market or something.
Yeah, they don't, you know, the car sells for $80,000, but they don't want to make two stickers. Because
you don't want to die because a French-Canadian guy is like, I bet that object is the exact size it appears, and I can't read that English,
right.
So I'm just going to go with that. And then he... plows into a wall.
Well, so in this case, Air Canada, the pilots talk to each other during the handoff, I guess. And in this case, it would have been an overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But Weir says to Pearson, hey, there's the flibbity jibbity with the FQIS isn't working, but here's the workaround. And Pearson says, well, you know what? I'm just going to put all the gas I need to get to Edmonton. We're stopping in Ottawa, but I'm not gonna worry about filling up in Ottawa.
I bet you couldn't do that today.
The
airlines would be like, nope, gotta be as light as you can.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're gonna spend, you know, $60 more in gas if you're full.
To fly that gas.
But this is the old gunslinging days.
Pilots can do stuff back then.
So he says, you know,
a proper country. And when I say we, I mean Canada.
Not fill her up to the top, because that would be insane, but give us enough gas to get all the way to Edmonton. I always love these Air Canada stories because there's only six towns in all of Canada.
they got a big dial on the pump. You just turn it. Okay, do you want or Canada, ka-chunk, or Calgary, ka-chunk, Vancouver? You know, there's just not that many options.
But here, a problem.
They could do one-letter airport codes.
That's right. E.
I'm going to E.
I'm going to V. A technician got on the airplane, went into the cockpit to confirm the broken FQIS. And in order to confirm it, he plugged it back in and confirmed.
It's broken.
It sure is broken. And he wrote it down in the log. But then, and this happens a lot in this story, somebody down on the ground said, hey, Jim, you know, you got it. Blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh, hang on. I'll be right there. And forgot to unplug it.
He knew he was supposed to. He just didn't do it.
He got distracted.
Mm.
And he was doing some other stuff. I don't know what he was doing. He was wiping it down up
probably there. Hash,
and he said, "I'm just, you know, I'll be right there." He needed to go look at the dipstick measurement, and he left it plugged in. Well, as we know, leaving the broken one plugged in disables the whole working system. One. So when Pearson got on board, he'd heard already that the FQIS was broken, and when he turned it on, sure enough, it was broken. But he hadn't quite the message that, because when Weir left it, the broken one was unplugged, the other one worked. That part of the equation was not transmitted between the two pilots. So Pearson gets on, the thing is broken. He takes a dipstick reading, and he does the conversion, centimeters to liters to kilograms to pounds and gallons, you know, to how many pounds of gas it is instead of kilograms, and how many gallons does that represent? Of course, the 767 and the people that the maintenance techs on the ground are aware that the 767 is a kilogram-based fuel system, and Pearson just gives them a number. I need 400.
See, when your math teacher said
units.
When your math teacher says you got to put units on, you're like, I did the thing. It's 380. 380 what? The thing says it's a, you know, it's a thermometer. What else is it going to be?
Anyway, so the plane takes off. It makes it to Ottawa just fine. And in Ottawa, they do it again. They put the dipstick in. The FQIS is still not working. The dipstick reads a certain number of centimeters.
But they repeat the...
And they repeat the miscalculation into from liters to pounds. And off they go.
Because it still seems consistent with what it should have been.
Everything looks good. The numbers are right. Now, in fact, when you convert from liters to gallons... In fact, they had about half the gas they needed. They needed 44,000 gallons, and they had 22,000 liters, or they needed 49,000. My, you know, as all Americans, I have no idea how to translate those things. I just generally think everything in metric is three times bigger than, except centimeters are smaller.
It's like a gallon's three or four liters.
3 or 4 liters. You know, when the first time you go to Europe and try and put gas in a car, and you're like, well, first of all, they don't say gas.
They say petrol?
Yeah, because gas is lighter than air.
Yeah, gas is not a liquid. It's a gas.
Not a liquid. So I don't even know why we say
gas. But the prices always seem very...
crazy.
Well, no, they seem very affordable because it's like per liter or whatever.
Oh, right. Crazy the other way.
Yeah.
Anyway, off they go. And they get up to a cruising altitude of 41,000 feet, which is pretty high. But they're flying east to west, so they're trying to get up above the jet stream. You know, usually when we fly...
That's something else planes don't do anymore is get up to 41,000 feet.
Yeah, we usually stay at about, what, 35,000 feet? Is that where we normally are?
Yeah.
41,000 feet, pretty high up there. And about halfway across Ontario, coming to the western border of Ontario, the warning bell sounds for the left side fuel indicator, and they assume that it's a fuel pump issue, which is also another like, oh, you know, hit it a couple of times.
Is this also the 767 does this kind of thing?
We're still figuring out like what all these things are. And the thing about gas in a, or rather petrol fuel, is that if you're in level flight.
It doesn't melt steel beams?
It does. First of all, it does not melt steel beams. That was actually a 767. Both the planes that went into the World Trade Center were 767s. So we know the gas doesn't melt steel beams, and that Building 7 was blown up by the CIA.
Controlled demolition.
No. But but gas will continue to gravity feed. It doesn't, you can continue to fly without a fuel pump as long as you're not doing inverted flight, as long as you're not.
If you do that, you have to stick your head out the window and siphon it with a little straw.
Yeah, well, you have to, what do you have to do? Yeah, somebody has to blow into a like a pump to keep the gas pressure up.
That's what the flight engineer was for.
The warning bell sounds, so they're like, yeah, you know, kill that alarm. It's probably just the fuel pump. But then the right engine alarm sounds, which got their attention. So they started to make plans. Like this seems like maybe a malfunction rather than that because they, you know, they know they have enough gas, but then the left engine stops. And they say, you know, they call Winnipeg and they say, hey, we're close to you and we're going to make a one engine landing.
By the way, an engine stopping is the kind of thing passengers might notice.
Yeah.
You got to wonder if they got on the PA.
Hey, everyone.
Nothing to worry about. Well, there
wasn't time because as they're on the radio to Winnipeg preparing for a single engine landing, the right engine goes off. And now, except for, as they described it, in the cockpit with their electronic dashboard.
They're playing Rush.
No, there's a very loud bong. Bong! That no one has ever heard before. That wasn't in any of the manuals.
That's what you hear, what an empty fuel tank sounds like?
Apparently, or? If both engines go off in a 767 in the first generation, there was programmed to be a bong. Just in case you missed it. Bong!
It's probably too late, but...
I think these are the only people, these two pilots are the only ones that ever heard the bong.
It would be a funny sound for, you know, the end of your prog record or for your ringtone or something.
Yeah, this is it, the big crash. Well, they immediately go to the manuals, and having been to, you know, flight school and having flown with my dad, you know, every airplane has a book, like a big book.
Is it spiral bound?
Yeah, of all the stuff you need to check, of all the checklists, because it's stressful up there and you would forget stuff. And even the most experienced pilots who have everything memorized backwards and forwards, they always pull out the checklist. It's just part of pilot culture. You just go, it's not a bipolar thing where you go, I'm sure I know it.
They're like rabbis.
You just go, that's right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, they open the book. They start going through the checklists. There are all those blank pages at the end where they haven't put in all the new stuff. But what is missing from the manual is what to do if both engines fail, because it has never occurred to anybody.
Boeing thought it would never happen.
This is the first two-engine jet, and there was no... They were just flying on hope and prayers that this couldn't and wouldn't ever happen.
And it only took like a few weeks for it to happen.
Yeah, bong!
You can't spell Boeing without bong.
They had at that point already started to descend in order to try and make it to Winnipeg, so they were at about, you know, 35,000 feet, both engines off. Well, the problem with that is that all of the electronic instrumentation was powered electrically by electrical power that was generated by the engines.
And there's not a battery or anything. Like, it's all gone.
Well, so...
What do they have?
All of the electronic instruments go dark. Poof.
In-flight movie goes dark?
Everything. Poof. Now, you still have... the cabin's still pressurized.
Yeah.
But you're not making any cell phone calls.
No, and there's... So really? No, even there's no emergency? There's no radio? Or...
Well, what then pops out of the side of the airplane...
Is it Otto? The autopilot from Airplane?
It's Otto, the autopilot. basically, it is. From the... On the outside of these airplanes, something that you may not know is that there's a little slot and it pops out a little ramjet propeller out of the side of the plane that just spins on the airspeed, the wind of the moving aircraft.
To give you current.
To give you enough electricity to control kind of the control surfaces of the airplane, because all of the flaps and ailerons are also controlled.
They're also electrical.
Now. Electrical. And so there's no, you know, both pilots pushing as hard as they could on the control surfaces couldn't move the giant flaps of this 767. So this little ramjet pops out, or not, it's not a ramjet, but a little ram air propeller pops out and gives them enough electricity that they can continue to control the plane with great physical effort.
Wow.
And so they now have, they have the barest instrumentation. I think there is some redundancy in terms of like airspeed indicator and like horizon indicator.
Horizon could be manual. I guess it's probably not though.
No, I think that is one of the instruments they have, but what they don't have is, I mean, most of their instrumentation, but also a rate of descent indicator. Mm. So they have no idea how faster they're falling.
And how fast does a commercial jet descend when it's not powered? Like, I mean, it'll stay up for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, planes love to fly.
They want to be up there.
But this is a major question, how fast they fall, because this isn't in the manual either, because it was never meant to happen.
I just don't have any sense of rule of thumb. Like, if you told me, no, it'll plow into a cornfield 10 minutes later or 10 hours later, I would not know which one is right.
Well, it is an airplane. It's meant to fly. It's not like those F-117s that God never intended to fly. And if those motors shut off, I don't know. I think that the thing actually turns around and goes backwards.
It's already crashed.
Yeah. As luck would have it, Captain Pearson is an experienced glider pilot and, like, glider instructor.
No way.
Yeah.
That's got to be rare. I mean, that's a niche kind of flight.
It is. And most pilots do not have this. And so he calls to Winnipeg and says, use your radar to tell us, like, where we are, how far we've gone, and how fast we're falling, or what our altitude is.
Yeah.
And then this is this wonderful moment of transition in American life, or in global life.
North American life.
That's
what Canadians say.
We have an all-electronic cockpit, but Captain Pearson has a slide rule and as part of his kit.
To figure out rate of descent.
And so gets on his, you know, he uses the Winnipeg radar ping, gets on his slide rule, calculates a glide ratio of 12 to 1. So for every 12 centimeters they go forward, they drop 1 centimeter. And using that, he realizes that they can't make it.
30,000 feet times 12. So they've got, you know, less than, what, 50 to 70 miles?
Yeah, right. And so in casting about, there's no place for them to land, no airport that can support a 767, except Monsieur Quintal was a Canadian, he's the co-pilot, Royal Canadian Air Force fighter pilot who remembered a decommissioned Air Force base called Royal Canadian Air Force Station Gimli.
Named for the Fellowship of the Ring member?
Named for the dwarf in Fellowship of the Ring.
A lot of people don't know this, but all of the Royal Canada Air Force air stations are named for dwarves from Lord of the... You could be assigned to Biffer Air Force Base, Beaufort Air Force Base, Bomber Air Force Base. That's where all the bombers are. The bombers are at Bomber.
Oh, that's nice. It's named Gimli because this is... there's a town called Gimli.
We're in Manitoba still?
We're in Manitoba, and Gimli is part of a region in Manitoba called New Iceland.
Wait.
Yes.
Iceland had enough people to make New Iceland?
Here's the thing. In Iceland in the 19th century, there were a lot of volcanic eruptions, and many of the dwarves and fairies in Iceland.
For the F this, we're going to Canada.
Yeah, they said, we're headed to Canada, and we would like a part of Canada that resembles Iceland, which is to say...
So the Canadian government cleared off all the vegetation.
No trees, and up there, lots of lakes.
Just some sheep walking around.
And so they managed, there was a diaspora of Icelanders to Canada. And actually enough that there's a new Iceland there. There's so much about Canada we don't know. Who knew there was a new Iceland?
Even Canadians don't know.
Gimli
Iceland sure doesn't.
Is a place in Nordic legend.
Yes, after Ragnarok.
That's right.
The good warriors, they don't go back to Valhalla, they go to a new
place.
A
post-Ragnarok paradise place called Gimli. So assuming the Icelanders were like, well, Ragnarok has come in the form of too many volcanoes, and now this is...
Oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, this is our new paradise.
This is our new paradise.
Manitoba.
Well, what...
That's how bad Iceland is, by the way, that Manitoba is the Edenic afterlife. Yeah.
What the Duke boys didn't know, what Quintal didn't know, and what the air traffic controllers in Winnipeg didn't know, was that after Gimli Air Station was decommissioned, they turned it into a racetrack drag strip go-kart place because things are boring up there.
There's mini golf.
Everybody loves drag strip culture. And so there is at this time a motor race
going on
a big motor festival, people filling the stands.
It's about to get a big surprise.
Cars drag racing up and down, lots of action. And here comes this 767 coming in hot. And they realize they're coming in too hot. The little Ram air propeller, as they try to slow the plane down using
They're
getting less electricity, and the flaps are less responsive. The plane is less responsive as they fly it. Yeah. And so the more they're trying to work it out, you know, the harder it starts to get. So much so that Pearson realizes that in order to actually land the airplane, in order to drop enough speed, he has to perform a slip.
What's a slip?
And a slip is a maneuver in an airplane where you put pressure on the ailerons one direction and you steer in the opposite direction. So the plane turns sideways.
I see you're no longer
you're flying now at a kittywampus, and then turns sideways and then drops, like you can, you know, turn into the sideways.
Yeah.
And so he uses a slip, which is not something you do with it's something you would do with a little plane, a glider, or a little Cessna.
You don't try it much with a 767.
Fighter plane. Nobody really does it with 767s. I don't think it was in the manual either. He figures it out. They put the landing gear down, but because their hydraulic system is also powered by the electricity of the engines, the hydraulics are not responsive really either, and the nose wheel won't lock. So the plane is it's coming in completely silent. There's no jet noise. The people at the racetrack.
Has Winnipeg been able to alert drag aficionados?
Air Force Base is closed. And so there's nobody to call. And so everybody's out there, rum, rum, rum. And then a jumbo jet appears.
Twist.
Coming in super hot. And
that'd be the best monster truck rally ever.
Pearson said that he looked out the window and there were two boys with their bicycles, like watching the race. And he said this jet appeared over their shoulder, you know, like dead silent. And he said he could see their faces and see the look of like teenage boy horror.
Disbelief.
At the fact that this airplane was about to land on their heads. Fortunately, the lack of a nose gear actually saved the day, because the plane landed, the nose gear failed, and there was a...
It wasn't down, right?
It had come down, but then collapsed.
Down, yeah.
And transmogrifying the Air Force Base into a drag strip, they'd put a railing down the middle in order to keep the drag racers from crashing into each other.
Yeah.
And so the plane straddled the rail, and then the nose gear collapsed, and the combination of the friction of those two things, nose on scraping the ground and straddling the railing, it actually slowed the airplane enough that it didn't fly off the end of it.
Absorbed the speed. That's amazing. Just imagining the nose of a 767 just riding a railing. Sparks are flying.
In front of a whole crowd that had come applauding. To watch Camaros do wheelies. Well, as you can imagine, everybody wanted to know who was at fault.
Yeah, this is Canada's Apollo 13.
Yeah.
The whole nation is glued to their televisions. This is the only thing that's ever going to happen.
Well, and they suspended both pilots. They suspended all the technicians.
They suspended both pilots.
That's the thing.
Look, if these guys had not been experts in gliding, yeah, trigonometry, and the location of decommissioned Canadian Air Force bases, there have been 100 dead people.
Well, what happened later was they set up all these conditions on flight simulators at 767flightsimulator.com. But also, you know, in the old days, like put pilots after pilots after pilots into this situation as part of a flight simulator, and none of the pilots could land.
They all died.
And so they realized that as you're saying, the combination of jet pilot or glider pilot and
slide rule expertise,
articulate, and then the fact that, you know, they knew about this lost airfield. It was a 1-2-3 magic. And in the end, both Quintal
exists, and he's Canadian.
God exists and loves Canadians. Quintal and Pearson were both reinstated. They were awarded the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale Diploma for Outstanding Airmanship.
And that's what I want.
Are kind of legendary like Air Canada air crews. What's insane is that they managed to get out there, fix up the airplane, fly it out of there, which was a big day
for an on-time arrival.
A big day for the residents of Gimli, and put the airplane back into service, and it remained in service until 2008. Regular service, Air Canada.
It's still got some scrapes on the nose.
Like, it continued to be an airplane and continued to be kind of this legendary, like, flight, what was it? Flight 143 was this incredible, you know, Air Canada event. It was the biggest thing that ever happened in Gimli. Sadly, and this happens so often, they retired the plane and sent it to one of those terrible airplane boneyards down in, you know, Arizona somewhere, Mojave Desert.
There's not a little Canadian Museum of Flight in every small city like we have.
So Gimli is like, well, this is the biggest thing we ever happened. We want the airplane. We want to, you know, put it on display. We have a parade every year. And the boneyard people were like, well, you can buy the airplane for $2 million.
Hey.
And Gimli like tried to raise the money. There was a big campaign. It was kind of like trying to save the music hall here. And they couldn't do it, and they ended up recycling the airplane.
It's a Kalevala type ship. No, not what was the name of the ferry?
The Kalakala.
Kalakala.
Yeah, they were like, nope, can't save it. Sorry, and they sold it to a company called Moto Art, and Moto Art takes old airplanes and punches little luggage tags out of the aluminum skin of the airplanes, and then sells them.
Wait, so you buy consumer luggage tags, and the gimmick is that they're made from actual airplane fuselages? Yeah,
they
that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
They punch 10,000 like little air tags, little luggage tags out of the fuselage.
That's depressing.
And sold them, and they're completely sold out now. I went to Plane Tags by Moto Art. They have a lot of different. You can get
You pick by the plane.
Yeah, you can get one from a Constellation. You can get them from a lot of different things. And this one was, you know, the Gimli glider, but they sold all 10,000 of them.
It's probably their fastest selling luggage tag ever.
The tragedy is that in 2017, the citizens of Gimli finally managed to open a museum to the Gimli glider, but all of the actual airplane was chewed up and made into luggage tags. So
look at that. The plane could survive losing both engines mid-flight, but it could not survive capitalism. And that concludes the Gimli Glider, entry 528.PS6104, certificate number 41746, in the Omnibus. Speaking of late-stage capitalism, we are at Omnibus Project on various social media networks.
And are we on Blue Sky yet?
I don't know. I guess I should. Yeah. I'm not going to blow an invitation on this piddling podcast. We'll see if Blue Sky catches on.
Yeah.
I'm at Ken Jennings on various social networks. John is at John Roderick on others. None of them the same. That's not true. We're both on Blue Sky.
Yeah, but I have been permanently banned from Twitter now.
You can be on, but you're on Instagram.
Yeah, I like Instagram.
I think I'm going to be Instagram only pretty soon. That's my prediction.
Instagram, it's still a pretty friendly place. You can post stuff, and it's not full of haters.
I just want to put pictures of my lunch somewhere.
It's just connected to Facebook, which is just such a awful place.
And Facebook, even worse, connected to Meta.
I don't even know what that is.
Google's connected to Alphabet.
Mm-hmm. The leg bone's connected to the knee bone.
You can send us things, send us email to theomnibusproject@gmail.com, send us physical items to
Oh, wow. That's actually a box.
P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. It was sent media mail, a very affordable postal service product that means...
It was sent in 2019?
It means this is either bound... Yeah, exactly. No, it's pretty fast, but this is either bound material or Brett, who mailed it to us, is committing postal fraud. So let's find out.
It has to be books or it's against the law to use...
It has to be media. So he could be sending us DVDs.
Okay, cool.
He could be sending us... Oh, wow.
What is it?
Oh, my gosh.
This you're pleased.
I am really pleased. This appears to be something on the order of between 50 and 100 1980s era Mad magazines.
Boom! Oh, my God. It's his Mad magazine collection?
The one I pulled out, Rambo First Blood Part 2, but also Night Court. We're going to have some Mort Drucker Night Court caricatures.
Night Court. How are you and I ever going to figure out who takes possession of these? Is this going to be one of those Beanie Baby court cases where you and I lay them out on the floor and we each get to take one at a time?
Oh my gosh, I think I had this one. Fake Trivial Pursuit cards on the back instead of a folding.
I had every one of these because I was a loyal Mad Magaziner during this period. What's the latest one? Because I would have stopped buying Mads about 1986.
I'm into the late 80s. They all appear to be right down the plate for me. Like, I see 83 to 89. Well, and there's some of the big square-bound ones that had all the reprints at the bottom.
Well, we could divide it up that way. I get 83 to 86, and you get 86 to 89.
We should just divide them up by who did the relevant omnibus. For example, here's the California Raisins on the cover.
You can have that one.
The Mad Fold-In is about poker players, but I can't see what the... Nobody has folded these fold-ins. This is remarkable.
This is so great. I can't wait to have these, but then my daughter will one by one just tear them to shreds.
She loves Night Court.
Doom, da, doom, doom, doom. What's the Night Court theme?
Boom. No, it's Barney Miller. Boom,
boom, boom. It had some kind of boom, ba, doom, boom. Yeah. Do, 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 do. That's Barney Miller.
It might be the same composer. It is a bass line like that. How does it go?
It's not the Seinfeld boom, dip, dip, boom,
bang. Now that I've heard Night Court and Seinfeld, or Barney Miller and Seinfeld, I will never hear Night Court.
But it does. It's a bassy one.
Mark Miles, play a little bit of the Night Court theme for us. Ah, there it is. Brett says, please accept this humble contribution to the Omnibus Archives. Ken and I were born the same year. I knew it, 74. His brief obsession with Mad Magazine started in 1985 to age 11. He left... in 1990, just a couple years after Don Martin did. Different reasons. Him for money, me for girls. maybe Don Martin thought he would meet more girls if he left Mad Magazine. Oh, these came from Brett in Ballard. P.S. Hooray for Media Mail. Brett, you could have probably just walked to my house. By some miracle, these survived 35 years in my mother's steamy New Orleans attic. When I found them, I knew exactly where they had to go. His mom didn't throw away his comics or his Mad Magazines.
She probably couldn't get up to the attic past a certain point.
The condition of this lot is more suitable for research than resale, but it's a neat window into the zeitgeist. Again, Night Court.
Yep.
And the California Raisins.
And we never resell anything. It all goes into the Omnibus library.
State license plate mottos we'd like to see. Texas, play football or die. Ha ha ha. Florida, America's drug dealer. That's kind of funny. Mad Magazine usually went for the first joke.
Yeah.
Nevada, land of 10,000 Elvis impersonators. Get it? Because Vegas has Elvis impersonators.
I do get it. Yeah, they had to put out an issue every month. They didn't have time to, like... You know, my daughter has started making puns.
Oh, boy.
And I have said, sweetheart, I will allow you to make puns until you're 13 years old, and then you have to stop. And she's very offended, because her puns are good. They're Ken Jennings-level puns.
Wow. Thank you so much, Brett. That was delightful. Send us all your Mad Magazines to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Find your fellow futurelings on Reddit or Facebook. There's a Discord, I think. John's on that. What's that sewer you're on called? 4chan?
Not anymore. I got permanently banned from there, too.
Wow, what do you have to do to get banned from 4chan?
It was a big misunderstanding.
It was a terrible series of very unlikely misunderstandings.
I am I'm permanently banned from everywhere except for
Denny's.
The metaverse.
You can be in the metaverse?
Yeah, so far. Who knows what next thing I'll say.
The most important thing of all, we have not yet been banned from Patreon.
Oh, thank
Thank goodness. John, you need to really keep your mouth under control on Patreon, if you would.
I know. I also need to diversify my income streams.
Yeah, if you want to make your house payment, maybe stay in Patreon's good graces.
I mean, so far I have been kicked off of almost everywhere I've ever been, including college. So
how many gas stations have pictures of you by the cashier?
I know. More and more. Well, virtual gas stations, they all have.
If you would like to support Omnibus, but you don't have Mad Magazine from the mid-80s at hand, there's only one way to do so. You need to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and support today. There are now 42 bonus episodes, monthly bonus episodes, that will be immediately at your fingertips. So if you're jonesing for a second weekly show, that's the way to do it. Listen to an addenda every Tuesday for a better part of a year.
Yeah, almost an entire year.
Thank you. If you support Omnibus, thank you for your support. We could not do it without you.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, or we may have to go to Gimli in New Iceland. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and specifically Icelandic whale cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.